How are you today? I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And we talk about many, many different things on this program. And if you're not convinced yet, I know you will be today. The title of this program, It's All About Food, it truly is all about food, especially when it comes to our health and preventing and reversing disease. It is truly all about food. So let's just get started. I'm so excited because I'm having one of my favorite people on the program to talk about a brand new book. Dr. Joel Fuhrman is a board-certified family physician and nutritional researcher who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. He is the research director of the Nutritional Research Foundation and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestsellers Eat to Live, Super Immunity, Eat to Live Cookbook, The End of Dieting, and The End of Diabetes. And now we've got The End of Heart Disease. Dr. Joel Fuhrman, how are you?
How are you doing?
Oh, good. I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. Excited to be talking to you today.
Thank you. Okay. Number one, the end of heart disease, the Eat to Live plan to prevent and reverse heart disease. Why is this your best book ever?
You know, today's the day it's released.
It's released.
It's really exciting. It's like, you know, it's certainly my longest book ever. But I hope that doesn't scare people off that it's 430 pages. But I felt it so important, not just to describe the nutritional plan that will dramatically lower your blood pressure and been studied, and of course the Nutritarian diet style has been studied to lower blood pressure in a study with 443 people. It drops systolic blood pressure 26 points on the average, which is much more than drugs and any other diet ever tested. But, besides dropping blood pressure, lowering cholesterol, dropping body weight, and reversing heart disease aggressively, and giving the people the program to do that, you know, I also thought it's very important to describe the myths and the fallacies associated with drug use and angioplasty and stent placement, especially the fact that high blood pressure medications do not offer significant protection against heart disease and stroke, and many of them are associated with higher rates of cancer. For example, the link between calcium channel blockers and breast cancer, you know, calcium channel blocker used for more than 10 years can double the risk of breast cancer. We're talking about statin use more than 10 years in breast cancer. We're talking about, in other words, here's my point, is that when people go through all the real futility and dangers associated with medications, like blood pressure medication, statin, and diabetic drugs, it becomes a no-brainer that they can't rely on drugs to get well. They don't work. They don't make you live significantly longer. They don't stop heart attacks from occurring. And they put you at significant risks of other diseases like we're talking about now, such as cancer. And that if people really had what I call comprehensive informed consent, if they knew the futility of conventional cardiovascular care, getting stent placements for obstructions that then for after that shorten your lifespan instead of lengthening it, and then they would recognize, you know, whether it's statins, whether it's diabetic medication, these drugs, they would recognize they have no choice. If they really want to stop their disease cold, reverse it, and not die prematurely of heart disease, they have to make these changes that are discussed in this book. And then I go into all the controversies, you know, is saturated fat good or bad? What's the stuff about hoopla about salt? I go through every issue in human nutrition and, of course, analyzing all the popular and proven dietary programs that have been shown to assist, help, or reverse heart disease, giving the pros and cons of each one, and giving people a comprehensive look at the available options out there. So I think this is the most comprehensive book available for the lay population and highly referenced. And, you know, I just think that every American has to read this.
I agree. And I read it. And
you did.
I enjoyed it. I love all your books.
How did you read it so fast? It was out today for the first time. They gave
someone sent it to me a few days ago.
Oh,
actually,
fantastic.
I got two copies and I thought I'd read it twice, but I only read it once.
Oh, I'm glad you read it already. Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm going to hit on some points that you brought up in the book. One of the things that I like about all of your books is they're intelligent. You don't dumb down the reader, but you present everything in terms that we can understand. It's all very digestible, very understandable, and that's really important.
Thank you.
So,
you know, and that's my that was my fear. I felt that this book had to get out there, but part of me felt it's like two people maybe won't want to know all this information, but I felt it's so important for people to get the complete picture here. That's why I had to make this book so lengthy, you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And, you know, it really isn't, I don't think it's that lengthy. I mean, there's a lot of pages, but some of it is filled with delicious recipes, which I want to bring up towards the end. I don't want to get right to the delicious stuff just yet. But some of it is very light and lovely.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Excuse me, Joel. This is my birthday month. I'm turning 58 later on this month. And as I age and as my friends and my family age, I hear more about what you were talking about when you just started. So many of my friends who are my age, maybe a little bit older, they're on blood pressure medication, statins. I had a teacher who was only 69 years old die of a heart attack a few months ago. Everybody that I know has some sort of coronary artery disease in one way or another. And it doesn't have to happen.
That's right. Totally, totally preventable and avoidable. And you're right in what you just said, that high blood pressure is the first sign of heart disease. It means you have cardiovascular disease if you have high blood pressure. And taking drugs doesn't remove it. And that over the age of 65, almost everybody is taking medications for their high blood pressure. You know, it's just amazing. You know, the whole American population has pathological cardiovascular disease and atherosclerosis.
Now, you in your press release for this book, it says that you assert that conventional treatments for heart disease are often ineffective and dangerous, and withholding proven effective dietary interventions as medical options should be considered malpractice. And that's a big mouthful. I wanted to mention that recently a family member of mine was in the hospital, and the cardiologist was recommending putting in a stent. He didn't even have any symptoms, but he did have a blocked LAD artery. And I was doing all kinds of reading, and I actually did speak to one of the cardiologists on the patient's team, and along with a cardiologist in my family's in my circle of family friends. And they both, after I talked to them and shared what I knew from you and your articles, they agreed with me, and they said, "Yes, there is no data that shows that stents prolong life." They agreed. And yet they figured, we have a blocked artery, so we're just going to unblock it. We have to fix it.
Yeah, well, it's really so sad that they're doing something. It's like people expect antibiotics with a viral infection. The doctor knows that it's not going to help them. But because people want it and expect it, they write a prescription for an antibiotic when the person just has a flu, a cold, or a flu, which is not going to work. And, of course, the antibiotic is then going to increase the risk of shortening their life, and the antibiotic is linked to breast cancer and, you know, dangerous infections later in life. Doctors give it anyway. And here we have this going on with angioplasties and stent placements because, you know, first of all, there's an opportunity for the physician. He's in a position of power, and the person's in a position of weakness and has a medical condition. And here's where the doctor can take him by the throat, you know, and say, "Look, you're going to die of heart disease if you don't do something and change the way you eat. I want to see you back in my office in 8 weeks, 20 pounds lighter. I want you to eat mostly vegetables. I want you to do this, and then we could beat this thing and make, you know." But instead, he just sends him in for a stent. You know, first of all, We want to say that, you know, the heart disease is spread throughout your whole heart like peanut butter spread over a whole sandwich. It's in millions of areas of your heart. It's not the one area that's obstructed. And the areas that are not obstructed are the areas much more likely to cause heart attacks, not the one that's most obstructed. The one that's oldest, the areas that have been there the longest that are most obstructed, have the most thickest calcified cap. They've been infiltrated with smooth muscle. The inflammation is gone. Those are not the spots that cause heart attacks. So they're treating the spots that are least likely to cause a problem, leaving all the other spots unaddressed, and they can't address the other spots. There's no way to do so. But here's my point, is that once you put that stent in, you expose this person to risk of death from the procedure itself or complications, and then you have a foreign body in the heart, which creates a nidus of inflammation and a propensity to cause a clot, and the doctor has to put you on an anti-clotting drug, maybe two of them or three of them for the rest of your life, thus increasing your risk of having a hemorrhagic stroke or a gastrointestinal bleed. So we didn't just not, it's just that there's no evidence that stents make people live longer or have a reduced risk of future heart attack, that's only half of it. They actually increase your risk of death. They don't just not decrease. They don't just not add years to your life, but they actually put you at increased risk of death and take years away from your life. And so we're not, of course, I'm not saying that's true with regard for a person in an acute emergency, like having an unstable heart attack at the moment, and the doctor has to put a stent in to possibly save their life because their heart's infarcting. That's a different story. We're talking about patients that are stable and having chest pain or having symptoms or having, they're not undergoing a heart attack at the moment. Then, of course, lobbying for people having fully informed consent, the doctor must discuss with them the proven approaches that we can reverse this, extend their life, and not dangerously and thoughtlessly put a stent in there.
It's very sad and very scary because a lot of people, they go in for medical help and they're told that's what they need.
And, yes, unfortunately, that's happening a lot. But what, you know, it's just as bad with the use of medication. Because people go in there to doctors, and what about, you know, stents, of course, happen, you know, a lot, but look at almost everybody gets put on a blood pressure medication and a statin without informed consent, never being told of those risks of, like, you know, here's what I'm saying here. If you're a woman and a calcium channel blocker after 10 years doubles your risk of breast cancer, and if the studies show being on a statin more than 10 years doubles your risk of breast cancer, what about people putting on the statin and the calcium channel blocker? What about those millions of people, and whether, you know, the point is, are these people warned of this risk? Are they told that if they eat healthy, they don't need these medications? Are they told that the risk of dropping their risk of heart attack or stroke is minimal from the medications, and it's 100 times greater if they change their diet? You know, in other words, we just have to change the way medicine is practiced.
Yes, and it's happening in little pockets, but we need some major breakthrough, and I hope your book is going to be the domino effect to get it going.
Well, you know, on the bright side, I did have the book reviewed by about 100 physicians before I sent it for the final, you know, publishing, and a whole, you know, dozens of cardiologists and have reviewed it, and I got such an incredible, enthusiastic response that doctors not only reviewed it, but they all wanted to order cases and cases of them to inform their patients of all this information. So on an individual basis, if, you know, of course, I mean, maybe this is a slanted sample because I'm sending it to cardiologists and doctors that I know about, and maybe half of them already have some nutritionally orientation, or maybe they're people that are somewhat aware of nutrition. But even my local cardiologist at local hospital, every person I sent it to, gave me very, very excited about the use of utilizing this book to give people comprehensive informed consent so they can convince them not to take the drugs or the procedures, but to change their diet. And so many of these doctors said, boy, I wish I had this book for my patients to read before I had to get prescribed medications. I'd much rather them do this than go on all these medications. So they all agree. It's just they're all complaining, though, that they can't convince their patients to do it. And that's my point, that, you know, if you give people enough information, it becomes a no-brainer. But you have to give people comprehensive informed consent, because that's why people aren't choosing to change their diet, because they don't really understand the real risks involved in medication and procedures, and they don't really see the benefits, the tremendous, incredible benefits of this kind of dietary modification.
Okay, another thing you mentioned earlier about the studies that are very confusing, and this adds to everyone being muddled about what to do, because last year we heard that butter was okay and cholesterol doesn't matter anymore and saturated fat is okay. I have a friend who was a raw vegan and then a vegan, and now she's into the buttered coffee and minerals in her bone broth and eating tons of meat. And what do we do?
You know, I mean, you know, these fads go in and out, and over time, you could say what's right or where the evidence lies, it comes through eventually. And I try to show in the book that the preponderance of evidence is overwhelming. In spite of these, you know, studies that are, you know, industry-sponsored, these fads that come and go and people jumping on the bandwagon of what's popular in America, in spite of that, we, you know, move forward in a steady pace, showing that heart disease can be predictably reversed, halted, stopped dead in its track, and reversed even in advanced cases when you have diets where animal products are dramatically reduced or eliminated. And every study that showed a long-term study with hard endpoints, and we're talking about soft endpoints versus hard endpoints, and the soft endpoint might be your lose little weight or your cholesterol goes down or your triglyceride drops or your glucose goes down, and we could set up those studies to show anything we want based on how the people are fed, but you know, and what the other foods we're feeding them. But hard endpoints are things like heart attacks over a 10-year period or death, which is the best hard endpoint, obviously. And now we have, and those long-term studies done 10 to 20 years are conclusive and not controversial. They just, and then I go through that in the book. I show one study and after another that as the percent of animal products are increased in a diet, heart attack rates and cancer rates both go up. And as animal product rates are decreased accordingly, we see those diseases go down. And we have to really look at studies that have hundreds of thousands of people in them, or at least thousands, and go on for 10 years or more to really see this effect and how dramatic it is. When we do look at those studies, the effects are quite startling and concerning that these people advocating these diets high in animal products are, you know, it's very irresponsible. And, you know, there's a lot of people with motives and agendas out there to prove something. And I'm kind of unique, I think. And you could tell me what you think, Karen. But I'm not advocating, you know, my specialty isn't ethics. It's not animal rights. It's not the environment. I'm not pressing people to be vegan. I do my job, which is to be an expert in human nutrition and give people the gold standard or ideal of what is to extend human lifespan. In a way so that I try to intentionally and intellectually not include any agenda or predetermined bias or personal ego that's going to have me slanted to prove one way or the other. I just want to present the facts for people so they can make the most informed decision possible. And I'm not saying that those other things aren't important, that ethics and environment and philosophies and all those things aren't important. It's just not my field of expertise, and I can let other people attack those things, and I can stick to what I do best, which is really an in-depth analysis of the scientific literature in an unbiased fashion.
Yes, I agree with everything you just said, and that's why you're my favorite medical doctor, because I know that you focus on just those things and you're an expert in those areas. And I'm so grateful to know that there's one place I can go to get the best information.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Now, I am a vegan, an ethical vegan, and I have been for 28 years. And in your book, you mentioned that it's okay to eat animal products, but you're very specific and it's really a very small amount that you allow.
That's right. Did you see that graph, which I show different varying amounts of animal products
like
in it?
Yes, like 5% of calories some instances.
Yes, because you know what it is? There's a bell-shaped curve of genetic predisposition. And, you know, we could say, let's just say, for example, you know, we know the American diet is 30% of calories from animal products, and that's the risky range of animal products almost every meal. If we look at all the blue zones, all the areas in the world where people have much longer lifespan, they all have less than 10% of calories from animal products. We look at studies where we actually are looking to see cholesterol drop and blood pressure drop. You have to move people, you know, below 20, below 15% into that 10% range as well. However, when we're looking at trying to guarantee reversal of a patient with heart disease in a predictable fashion, then we start to see for most people we need to drop it even lower than that, below that 5% figure. And there's other doctors, as you know, like Dr. Dean Ornish and, you know, others who have the, you know, DASH diet, the Pritikin diet, the Gipro. I went through all the other diets with proven scientific documentation to cause reversal of heart disease, demonstrating that for predictable reversal, for not just to reverse, you know, a small part of the population, to protect a small part, to protect the vast majority of people, you have to push animal products relatively low. So then the question is, okay, that's for prevention, but now what if you have a person that has advanced heart disease and you're looking to reverse it? Where do you have to go? And that's where I'm, you know, saying that you have to get below that 5% figure, or we're not going to see heart disease predictably reverse in the vast majority of cases. Not that some wouldn't reverse in the 10% figure, but I want to make sure that everybody reverses. And the data we have today, what we have available, the studies available, show that for predictable reversal, why not go below that 5%? Because that's what the data shows. So that's 0 to 5, and that's what Ornish has done, for example, and that's what I'm doing. And as you know, what's kind of interesting in the book is to see that all the evidence that including nuts and seeds in the diet promotes reversal, and you don't have to exclude all fat from the diet to have reversal occur, that we can do so while still eating us an adequate amount of whole fats from like foods like nuts and seeds, which is, you know, where you can make food taste great, and we can make the diet style taste fantastic as well.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up. The other doctors that have preventable and reversible heart disease plans, and the issue of nuts and seeds. I'm just wondering, what I like about your approach is you tell it like it is, and you don't dumb anybody down and assume anything. You just say, this is what you need to do, and that's what I appreciate most. But I know that some people, when they see, oh, I can have some of this, some of these animal products, a little fish or a little milk or whatever, for them, they may not realize what 5 or 10% is and what 3 ounces is versus 6 ounces, and it might open the floodgates. But at least you're telling them what they need to do and they can make a choice. I had talked to Dr. Esselstyn last year.
You can eat too many dates, too. You can eat too many dates and raisins. You can have, you know what I mean? So people can make all kinds of mistakes, but I want to give them specific guidelines, and if they can follow those, then if they don't want, you know. So in other words, I'm not expecting all of America to eat like this or to change like this, but I think that all of America needs to know it. And then it's like smoking cigarettes. You don't want to think that smoking cigarettes is okay and then have it kill you. You at least want to know it's going to kill you if you will choose to do it. You know what I mean?
Yep. In order to get everybody moving to a better place, we need to move that curve and have the information out there, what the ideal is, what the best is, what the most powerful thing is.
You've got to know what the ideal is. Then people can choose to follow it or not. That's exactly my point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cholesterol. As I mentioned before, I'm a long-term vegan, and I've always had high cholesterol. And you talk about fluffy LDL and OX or OX LDL, and
right.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, and should I be worried?
You know, I just had a person question me this with like on a patient just a couple of days ago. You know, they had a total cholesterol of like 120 or 100. No, I mean LDL cholesterol 120, 130, and their oxidized LDL was like 30. You know, it's like, in other words, their LDL is not oxidized. It's the oxidized LDL that's dangerous. And we're getting LDL concentration numbers that, you know, don't tell us how much of that LDL is a really bad LDL, good LDL, or bad HDL, or good bad HDL. In other words, we're just getting numbers which are, you know, somewhat of an indicator, and certainly lower is better than higher on the LDL. But when you eat a diet high in phytochemicals and micronutrients, you don't have free radicals, and your LDL is not oxidized. So what I'm saying is that your LDL on a healthy diet is much more, even if it's double or even if it's somewhat 30, 40 points higher, is much healthier than pushing your LDL down with drugs with your LDLs oxidized. In other words, mm-hmm. the most accurate determinant of risk is your oxidized LDL, more than your even total LDL. So and the point is that we need to eat these green vegetables, the berries, the G-bombs I refer to, the onions, the mushrooms, the berries, the seeds, but particularly the green vegetables, you know, and the green vegetables and also berries, and, you know, have tremendous and powerful antioxidant effects to prevent cancer and also to prevent atherosclerosis and to reverse heart disease. We can see that if we measure the lutein in a person's bloodstream, it correlates with the degree of atherosclerosis. High levels of lutein, lower rates of atherosclerosis. Mm. Low levels of lutein, high degree of atherosclerosis. Perfect correlation. So then people would say, well, wow, lutein must be the magical nutrient because this has a direct correlation with heart disease. And people with higher luteins reverse their atherosclerosis. But see, lutein is like the flag that marks a diet high in green vegetables, because green vegetables have thousands of nutrients in them, but the carotenoid that makes their color green is called lutein, and you can measure a person's green vegetable volume in their diet by measuring the lutein in their blood. It's not the lutein did all the work, but of course we're measuring the person's green vegetable intake through that blood level.
Okay, well, I'm sure I'm ringing all the bells on my green level, so I'm not going to be concerned about it. There was an article in the New York Times just this weekend about a new drug that's supposed to lower LDL cholesterol, and the results were very disappointing, and it was tested on 12,000 patients, and the Dr. Stephen Nichols, the principal investigator. He said, it's the most mind-boggling question. How can a drug that lowers something that is associated with benefit not show any benefit? Did you find that mind-boggling?
I didn't find the study mind-boggling like others would. But I thought it was kind of interesting. But, you know, my whole book's about this. I thought it's kind of interesting, the timeliness of my book coming out on the same day that this article, this op-ed in the New York Times comes out showing these drugs have no benefits, even though they lower LDL and raise HDL, you know what I mean? So I think that it's funny because the whole point we're talking about is that these cholesterol numbers are just a small part of the heart attack and heart disease equation. And people run around thinking they're protected because their LDL is favorable, and they don't realize that's just a very small part, a contributing risk. But your waist measurement, your body fat, your blood pressure, the quality of your diet, your fitness level, you know, all these things are more important than your cholesterol level, or equally important, and there's multifactorial disease. And just because you have one favorable, and of course the statin drug pushes it down, but it pushes down your LDL total, and you could still have a lot of oxidized LDL in there, even though your level is normal. And it's just one risk. As people recognize that most people under care of doctors and cardiologists for their heart and high blood pressure still die of heart disease. The drugs do not protect them. And they don't even protect them much at all. I mean, there's always risk. Maybe we're talking in most studies, depending on which study you look at, between 10 and 20% reduction in risk. And we're talking here about nutrition being able to give people close to a 99% reduction. And in my 25 years of practice, even in people with the most advanced cases who couldn't even get out of a wheelchair or a housebound or on 10 medic, even people with, you know, low ejection fractions, even these people made recoveries. And, you know, we're talking about even the most severe cases have hope to get better. And drugs and procedures don't give it to them. It's the change in diet that's going to give people hope and has the proven efficacy to reverse disease that drugs and procedures can't do.
And that's where the second part of your book comes in, where you offer a meal plan and some really luscious-looking recipes. I dog-eared some pages because I want to try some of them. And my first question is, it said in the book you were 15 when you started cooking, and I wanted to know a little bit more about that and how you learned to cook.
Huh. That's a, you know, you know, my father was a pretty sick guy, an overweight and sick guy. I remember in one of my childhood driving around in the back of a station wagon, lying on a mat because he couldn't sit up, you know, from doctor to doctor. But he changed his diet and got healthier and started running, getting in, you know, and I read those books he brought into the house. And so we kind of like did it as a family. And I started reading all these books, you know, from natural hygiene and from the, you know, the vegan movement. And I got involved with them and started learning recipes when I was really young. So my point is that now that I'm in my 60s, I've been doing this, you know, doing these recipes and making food that's, you know, healthy food tastes good and all these tricks, you know, for many, many years. And, I, you know, when you cultivate and you meet people and you cultivate a diet that's really pleasurable and satisfying and delicious and healthy at the same time. And if people knew that they can marry together all those features, I think they would really feel more comfortable. This is not about giving up or feeling deprived. It's about actually feeling more pleasure about the way you eat, because when you intellectually know you're doing what's good for your body and you feel great and it tastes good too, you enjoy eating more. It's like you enjoy eating and you enjoy eating with freedom, and you know what? Living your life in fear of disease can't be that great and can't be that good for your health. To be always worried about, you know, you're going to get some disease or be struck and dead with a heart attack if you run for a bus or something. You know what I mean? It's nice to know that you protect yourself.
Absolutely. I'm just thumbing through. We've got Mao Luo wok sauce, which looks like a really tasty sauce to put on vegetables, and all kinds of wonderful dressings, a Russian fig dressing, baked eggplant fries that looks amazing. And all of these foods are nutritious, nutrient-dense, plant-rich, and you don't miss anything. So the bottom line is you can prevent and reverse heart disease and eat better than you've ever eaten before and love your food. That's about it, right?
Yeah, I guess that's the whole point.
Okay.
You know, well, and the whole point is to get people to get off their drugs. And let me just make this one quick point.
Yes,
is
please.
That your risk of heart disease is proportional to the number of medications you're taking. And you got it. That you're only, if I want to give people that guarantee never to have a heart attack or a stroke, they have to earn it. And the way they earn it is by having a normal blood pressure without medication, a normal cholesterol without medication, and a normal glucose number without medication, a normal body weight. They've got to, it's not, you know, no, they've got to do it themselves. Nobody can do it for them, and they can't buy it in a bottle. They can't buy protection in a bottle. They've got to do it themselves, because the more drugs they're on, the higher the risk they have.
Thank you. I'm applauding you. And thank you for another great book, and I hope this truly is the end of heart disease for many, many people.
Thanks, Karen.
And here's thank to you. The next, your next book on the New York Times bestseller list.
Woo! I hope so. Thanks a
of
lot.
Of course. Okay, take care. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Joel Fuhrman. I want you to digest that for a few minutes, and we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to be back with my partner and co-founder of Responsible Eating and Living, Gary DeMattei. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and we're back for the second part of today's show. And I've got Gary DeMattei with me, the co-founder of Responsible Eating and Living. Gary, how are you
today?
Wow,
I'm really a lot better now since listening to your show. That was great, Dr. Fuhrman and you. Excellent show. Well done.
You know, I've known Dr. Fuhrman for 20 years, and the first time I heard him speak, it was at an Earth Save Long Island lecture 20 years ago, and maybe it was 18 or 19, but it was sometime around there, and he was talking about an earlier book, Fasting and Eating for Health, and I was riveted. I got the book. It was amazing. I learned so much. I ended up doing a three-week water-only fast at one of Dr. Fuhrman's fasting houses. He doesn't have one anymore, but I knew right away after listening to many, many speakers on health and nutrition that this guy really knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, and it was really a lot of fun to meet him. We met him a couple of times. I met him a couple of times with you. I know you know him well. And to perform for his weekend
health immersion,
the Swingin' Gourmets performed, and that was awesome. The audience was, it was the end of this really long weekend, and so we got to wrap things up for them. And I'd like to do it again for him, only this time I'd like to be the opening act, because
they were tired
after going through that much cleansing. They were a great audience, but they were just a little tired. And he really puts it through your paces, and you're all the better for it. And so, well done.
I remember you coming out of the men's bathroom.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story.
Some conversations by some men who were experiencing some new bowel activity after eating a nutritarian diet for a weekend.
After eating a lot of beans for the weekend, the real show was in the men's room, I want to tell you. It was like that scene around the campfire in Blazing Saddles. I won't go any further because this is a family show. So, yeah. But that's good for you, right? I mean, let's talk a little bit about flatulence. That's not a bad thing.
We pass gas all day long, and it's part of the process. The question is when it becomes uncomfortable and when it fills up spaces and puts pressure on things and maybe isn't as fragrant as you'd like it to be.
Yeah.
But there are ways to work around that. And don't stop eating beans if you're concerned about gas.
Now you and I are doing something that you talked about the other day, which I think is really an interesting aside. Couples who talk about what we were just talking about actually have good relationships, right?
Oh, yeah. I think it was a Huffington Post article that couples who talk about poop have a healthier relationship.
In more ways than one. But seriously, folks.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I got to look that one up.
Yeah.
So I'm
here to talk to you about food. What else?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say one more thing about Joel Fuhrman.
Let's say a lot
more. You know, I've said many times he's my favorite doctor, and there's many reasons why. I have a great deal of respect for his knowledge and his integrity, and he from a personal level, he has been very special to me when I was going through my cancer experience, and he reviewed a lot of things, and he was available on a consultation call with another expert, and he reviewed all my supplements that the Block Center where I was having chemotherapy, what they recommended. And, you know, it really, it's scary when you're going through a health crisis, very scary, and you don't know who to trust, and you want to trust your doctor. And there were many doctors that I knew that were experts or excellent or not so, but I didn't know that I could trust any of them. And to know Dr. Furman and know I could trust him was like a lifeline.
Oh, I know. And, you know, the other thing is that I know you and I were talking about this before going on the air, but what Joel does, Dr. Furman does, and I know another one of your favorite doctors is Dr. Greger, what they're trying to do, I think, and you may have already touched on this, is they're trying to get you, they're doctors who are trying to tell you you don't need doctors. I mean, sure, you need them if you need something removed or you break something that needs to be set. You need them for the emergencies that life gives us. But right now we seem to have a system, which I know absolutely nothing about. This is just my subjective opinion, and I'm trying to think about it objectively, like a good artist, to look at things through my subjective lens and then to think about them objectively is what an artist strives for. And so I'm trying to do that now with what it is that is going on in my life as a vegan. I will be, this is my, see, it's 2016, it was early 2007. So what is that? 9 years now as a vegan. So, and it just keeps, you know, little doors keep opening up to bigger rooms that you have to navigate when it comes to, how wonderful this lifestyle is, how it makes sense, and how a plant-based diet or a nutritarian diet, I know that, Joel's is called a nutritarian diet. But whatever you call it, when you dominate your diet with plants, you don't need doctors. And what doctors are trying to tell you that aren't promoting this lifestyle is that you need them because without them, without their prescriptions, you are not going to have a healthy life. And that's just false.
That's just such a good point. You know, we need doctors for physical things. If we break a leg, something physical needs to be patched together. But there are all these chronic diseases that if we were eating a healthy diet, we wouldn't need them, or we would need them a lot less often. And right. I just wanted to ask you a question, Gary. Were you listening when Dr. Furman talked about antibiotics and viral flus?
Of course, Karen, of course. I was listening, and I appreciated it because I was really getting nervous when you were sick for a while recently, and I kept saying, you know, there are antibiotics in America. You can, it has saved a lot of people, or they have saved a lot of people, but you didn't need them, and you were right, and I was wrong, and so I'm sorry.
Yeah, it has been a slow recovery from that flu. That was a pretty, pretty nasty flu.
Right. I talked to a lot of people about there's a lot – I haven't talked to them, but I've seen that a lot of people have this really bad flu this season all over the country. And of course, it's true because I saw it on Facebook. But a lot of my Facebook friends have the flu, and they've had a tough time getting rid of it. So it's a bad flu season.
Something I forgot to mention, and I was going to bring it up at the top of the program, and I always forget, but for all of you listeners out there, you can always call in and ask questions during the program. And I always get so excited when my guests are coming on that I forget to mention it, and I was going to mention it when Dr. Furman came on, and I didn't. I apologize. But if you have any questions you might want to pose to Gary and myself, the number is 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-478. No. Okay, now I'm getting confused. I wrote it down here. Let me get it right.
You're doing great, Karen.
Yeah, 1-888-874-4888. Yeah, you know, if you know PRN, that's the number, right? Anyway, and you can always email me at info@realmeals.org.
Or you could send us a tweet. You could send us a tweet at realmeals.
Oh, tweet at Real Worldwide. We're Real Worldwide on Twitter. Yeah.
Real Worldwide. Say that three times fast. Real Worldwide. Okay, so we've sent out a newsletter. And on the newsletter was the – in the newsletter was the advertisement today for your show with Dr. Joel Fuhrman, The End of Heart Disease. And if you haven't received our newsletter, you can also go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and sign up to receive our newsletter.
We don't send them out very often, maybe once a month.
We don't have those pesky pop-ups at our website because we are a nonprofit and we don't make any money. So nobody wants to advertise with us, pop-ups. It's just fine. We were just talking about this last night at a meeting where we're really glad that we have this small yet mighty audience that we have of loyal followers, because who wants to deal with all those pop-ups when you go on a website?
And I don't.
And so some of the websites even have this screen that come up that say, sign up for our newsletter and stay up there until you do sign up for the newsletter. Otherwise, you can't enter the site.
Yeah, or you find the small print that says, no, I'm not interested or whatever.
Right.
Well, this newsletter that we put out includes some of our latest recipes, and I wanted to talk about some of them. The first one is a Gary DeMattei creation, and it just blew me away.
Yeah.
A creamy kale pesto. Can you tell us about your genius, superfood, nutritious, delicious, super creamy kale pesto? Did I say super?
Well, you know, first of all, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. First of all, it's basically because of your divine inspiration and all of the things that I keep picking up, the little doors that I was mentioning earlier that keep opening up, and, you know, hearing you discuss how oil, refined oils, are really pretty bad for you. I mean, and so how do you make pesto without olive oil? So what
how
we
does
do,
an Italian make pesto without olive oil?
So I was thinking back to my days as an actual chef. And I remember this was back in the 80s when the big Wolfgang Puck, Alice Waters, that big California cuisine movement was going on, and I was living in Northern California. And there was this dish at one of these wonderful little restaurants. It could have been Chez Panisse at the time. This was before I was a vegan, of course. But it was a walnut pesto, which obviously everybody knows about walnut pesto. But I think it was Alice made it with, well, not with basil, but with spinach. She made a spinach walnut pesto, and we all know about that. You don't really need basil. And so I was thinking, but obviously she used olive oil and a lot of olive oil, and we all use olive oil in our pesto, or most of us do. And so we make these seed Caesar and little seed Caesar dressings by using our Vitamix. And I know many of you have a Vitamix, and if you don't have a Vitamix, you should really invest in a Vitamix. They're amazing, but if you don't have the money for a Vitamix, or you don't want another appliance and you have a blender sitting around, that's all you need for this recipe. The old-fashioned way to do pesto is with a mortar and pestle. And if you have the elbow grease and want to do it, you can certainly try to make it with a mortar and pestle, but I don't recommend it. I recommend using a blender, because what you're doing is you're blending the nuts with the water, and or in this case for the kale, creamy kale pesto, you're blending the nuts with the non-dairy milk. And so it's essentially a no-oil pesto, but you're blending the walnuts, so that's creating the oil, and then you're adding the nutritional yeast and the unsweetened, I use soy milk, but you could certainly use an unsweetened dairy milk of your choice, the garlic cloves, the black pepper, and then you're waiting to put the miso in. You can leave the miso out. What the miso does is it adds a little cheesier flavor, but really the nutritional yeast handles that. I don't recommend putting the miso in if you want to store this in a jar in the refrigerator. I recommend leaving the miso out, because miso has a tendency to stay active. And if you're giving it something to stay active in, it won't last more than a day in your refrigerator if the miso is in there. It'll last 3 or 4 days if the miso isn't in there. So, but if you're going
to
use
it, I also wanted to add that we like South River miso. It's organic and they have many different flavors. Some of them are gluten-free, like their chickpea miso. And their misos aren't as salty as some of the traditional Japanese brands out there, but they're very flavorful.
South River is really, really great. So anyway, just the instructions are on the recipe, but it's a basically throw everything in the blender and blend it up until smooth. And then, as you mentioned, heat it up in the pan and add your pasta to it or whatever it is you want to saute with it. And it's incredible. It's unbelievable. And you'll never miss the oil. Because
I just can't believe how good it was. And for people that don't like kale, it doesn't have a kale flavor. It has that garlic rich flavor.
Right. And, you know, there's variations on that. You can use kale leaves. You can use collard leaves. You can use spinach. You can use any dark leafy green that you want to use. And you can put it right on the hot pasta. You don't even need to put it in the pan. You could put it right on the hot pasta and stir it up. And it'll work. It'll work great. But, you know, you're all chefs out there. You know what I'm talking about. What this is just it's just reminders that you don't need to stay with one ingredient. You don't need to stay with fresh basil if you've got kale out there. And it's still winter here in New York. I mean, I know they say it's spring, but there's a lot of
freezing today.
Yeah. We were at the Veggie Pride Parade, which we also wanted to talk about. And it was cold. It was really cold.
Yeah, this was the 9th annual Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan. We've been to the last 8. It seems like it's getting colder and colder.
I always learn so much when I go. You know, I mean, I'm there with you, and you were a guest speaker, and you did an incredible job. And the crowd was very attentive and lovely, and they had lots of great guest speakers, and I always learn something from the guest speakers. I always think I've heard it all, you know. I'm not going to learn anything, and this year I can't remember who she was. She spoke before you. You'll know who she was, but she talked a lot about fish, and she said one thing, and I was walking around filming the crowd because we're working on another.
Guess what, Gary? We've got a caller. Let's get back to that. Let's take our caller, Mike from Hawaii. Aloha.
Hi, Mike.
Hello. How you doing? Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. So I'm sorry, I'm a little off topic. I'm a first-time caller, but God, it sounds like incredible amount of great information you guys are spreading out here.
Thanks.
You hinted on oils. Have you did any research about MCT oil or any of that?
What kind of oil?
MCT oil, multi-chain triglyceride oil. It's, one of the best parts of the coconut oil.
Oh, coconut oil. Yeah, well, you have to understand that we're fans of Dr. Joel Fuhrman, who was my guest earlier on in the program. And he talks about how no oil is really a healthy food because it's processed, it has no fiber, and there haven't really been any convincing studies to show otherwise. So the best place to get fat is from whole foods or minimally processed foods, raw nuts and seeds, the actual coconut and avocado, things like that. But I like to use coconut oil on my skin. And I'll use it occasionally in food, but we're not big oil users.
Yeah, but you know what? I was just talking about blending nuts, which have a lot of oil. And let's say you have a dressing that you just can't live without. What I have found is that if you take a quarter to a half a cup of your favorite raw nut, like what we do is we do these dressings we call seed Caesar dressings. And it's because instead of oil, we make a Caesar dressing with sunflower seeds or with pumpkin seeds, and we blend them, and you won't, you know, and you're getting the oil from the nuts, but you're also getting the fiber from the nuts, and you don't even miss the oil.
I know there's a lot of websites and a lot of articles that really promote coconut oil and different kinds of oil, saying that they're healthy, but I really haven't seen the science behind it.
I also have a lot of family members, because I come from Italian descent, who use olive oil. And the thing that I've, you know, and they can't live without olive oil, just like I know a lot of people can't live without coconut oil and feel like they, you know, they really can't do without it. But as far as those who can't live without olive oil or coconut oil for that matter, I would then take some olives, pitted first, of course, and then add it to the nuts that I'm blending, and it would give you an olive oil taste, because raw sunflower seeds, for example, are kind of tasteless when you blend them with garlic and olives and things like that. The taste kind of goes away, but you still get that heft, that fat. That's really neat.
So I wanted to – thanks very much for that question, by the way.
Thank you for the question, and thank you for the call.
Can I ask you a couple more questions? I'll make them quick.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're fasting. I'm a big person on low-end and mild fasting here. I used to – I've had a few bizarre diets, but one was, you know, like the 22-hour fast, 2-hour of eating, and that was really great for a while. You know, about 4 or 5 hours after you wake up in the morning, you know, you go kind of through the hunger pains and the emptying and everything, but then you feel fantastic the rest of the day. Can you tell me about the And 3 weeks, I think the most I ever did was 7 days, 3 weeks, holy cow.
Well, yeah, Dr. Furman's book, Fasting and Eating for Health, is an excellent book on the subject. And if you're going to do any kind of fast, but most importantly, a water fast that's extended, you must rest. You must give your body the opportunity to go to work and heal the areas that need work. And what I did was the first week and a half, I stayed at home. And then the second portion of the fast, I was really slowing down. And that's when I stayed at the fasting house and rested a lot, went for very slow walks, and just sipped on water. And you can't go to work. You can't really do anything. It's all about rest and healing. And I love the experience. I mean, some people would think I'm crazy, but there's all different kinds of fasting, 1 day fast, 2 day fast, a week or more.
So what you're saying, Karen, is that a fast is really slow.
Exactly. Yeah.
How did you feel on that 3 week endeavor? How did you feel like your first few days in? Did you feel really good and energized, or did you feel kind of slow all throughout?
So the first few days were the hardest because I was hungry. And then like 2 days into it, that's when the body realizes it's not being fed and it feeds on its non-essential stores. And I just wasn't hungry anymore. So that was amazing.
Yeah, I experienced it myself. I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah. So we just have 3 minutes left. And did you have any more questions, Mike?
I do, but they're not clear in my head right at the moment. Like I said, I'm a first-time listener, and I'm going to try to call in next week. And
awesome.
I'm definitely going to jump on the Joel Furman bandwagon. Yeah, sounds fantastic.
Yeah, good. You might, if you read the Fasting and Eating for Health book, he talks about how he did a fast. He was a professional. First, he was a competitive figure skater when he was young, and he had a bad accident where he couldn't walk, and he ended up using water fasting to heal. It's an incredible story. Okay, we just have a couple minutes left.
Thanks,
Gary,
Mike. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Gary, I wanted to mention you were talking about Mary Finelli of Fishfield, who was at the Veggie Pride Parade.
Right. So anyway, she talked about some great things, and then I'll just leave you with this. She said, fish are one of the animals that children are encouraged to kill. And that's just been like resonating with me, because she was talking about how fishing, you know, and this is the season that's coming up now where people are taking their kids fishing and grandpa's taking little grandson fishing or what have you. And
I'm thinking of Hallmark card pictures where you see the little boy and the grandfather's backs to the water with their fishing rods.
It's really, on the one hand, it's idyllic and lovely, and the scene is really lovely. But then when you think about it, fish are one of the animals that children are encouraged to kill. You think about the fact that fish can feel and have all of those little nerves in their mouth, and, you know, the concept of catching a fish and throwing it back in. It's chilling. And these are, like I said, I keep opening, these little doors keep opening up and walking me into these rooms that it's very symbolic. And so I'll leave you with that downer note. No, seriously, though. Thanks for everything, Karen, and I will see you back at Responsible Eating and Living.
Okay. Thanks, Karen DeBattei, for joining me today on It's All About Food. And thank all of you for joining me. And I hope you all can think about calling in, because I'm going to really encourage the calls. So join me next week. And remember, go to visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where we live. And we give you lots of recipes so that you can have a delicious week. Bye-bye.